In this episode of The Encrypted Economy, I was really excited to have Matt Walsh, the co-founder of Castle Island Ventures, as well as the co-host of the On the Brink podcast on the show. I've been following both Matt and his co-founder, Nick Carter, for a few months now, and have been pretty impressed with their thoughtfulness in the blockchain and digital asset space, as well as their investment selection. Certainly, their investment list is directly in line with the thesis of the encrypted economy. Matt and I talked about how investing in blockchain technologies and digital asset technologies is different than investing in other ventures, the obstacles that these spaces face, what it takes for leaders to embrace the change that comes along with moving in these spaces. And we even moved on to topics like digital currency and the potential ramifications for the economy, depending on which way central bank digital currencies go. So it was a very insightful, intriguing podcast. I enjoyed it tremendously, and I think you will too. Welcome to The Encrypted Economy, where we look at the business of regulation and security for all things encrypted, digital assets, blockchain technology, privacy, and smart contracts. Hope you'll join us while we explore these forces that are shaping the economy. On the Encrypted Economy today, I'm really excited to have Matt Walsh, founder of Castle Island Ventures and host of On the Brink on the show. Prior to founding Castle Island Ventures in June of 2018, Matt was a vice president at Fidelity Investments, where he led a number of the firm's blockchains and crypto initiatives. And from there, he launched Castle Island Ventures with Fidelity's backing as well. So pretty exciting time. In 2019, they started On the Brink. And how many subscribers do you currently have?
I don't know, but yeah, a lot of people listen to it. You put these things out there and I'm always surprised that people listen. We just started it as a way to speak with interesting people and have fun conversations that we would normally be having anyway. But yeah, we're really thankful that people are listening to it.
Yeah, it's great. I can say that I'm not fully caught up yet, but I am well over the 70% mark, excluding the weekly roundups, which are also good, just dated if I'm going too far back.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
I gave a little bit of a background on you and maybe a little bit of what drove you to go ahead and launch your own venture fund.
Yeah, sure. Thanks again for having me on, Eric. I've been enjoying the first few podcasts that you've put out there. Yeah, it was a wild ride. I was really fortunate that I ended up working at Fidelity at a time when we started to really care about Bitcoin and blockchain. So I started with the firm in 2014. Initially, I was in the strategy group, actually, and started working on a project that the firm does every 3 or 4 years called scenario planning. So really looking at disruptive visions of what the world might look like 10 years from now. And the exercise is to almost war game around what the firm would have to do in order to be prepared for that eventual disruptive world. We were looking at Bitcoin initially through the lens of a peer-to-peer frictionless capital market. So a world where any asset can be moved peer-to-peer. And what would happen to Fidelity's business in that world. So that became this kind of crazy journey that I got on that I was fortunate enough to ride along with at Fidelity, where we were exploring Bitcoin through the lens of a new asset class and looking at blockchain technology as this foundational plumbing that could really change what the core business looked like. And so it was a great ride and eventually led to us starting a small pilot fund under Fidelity's umbrella, investing in crypto assets and early stage companies. It really became a big enough opportunity in Nick and I's mind that we thought that this was our entrepreneurial wave to hop on and had a clear view of what we wanted to do in terms of starting an early stage venture fund and supporting really some of the foundational companies that we thought were required in order for institutions and real people to actually start engaging with public blockchains, not only for financial use cases, but for a variety of non-financial use cases as well. And so really saw the need for some of these early stage companies to exist and build some of that plumbing and decided that's what we wanted to do with our careers. And we left and we were fortunate enough to get off the ground in 2018 with Castle Island and have been enjoying it ever since.
Excellent. And Fidelity is still leading the charge in crypto assets, moving into custody much more aggressively than other bigger institutions. I know you keep in touch with them. They're obviously an investor. You want to weigh in a little bit on that?
I think the big takeaway here is that the companies that are the most impactful in this industry are the ones where the top senior leadership, whether that be the founder or the CEO, is just very bought in and willing to persevere through these troughs of disillusionment that we've had throughout the course of this industry. And so if you think about Fidelity's journey in the space. 2014 to 2016, I wouldn't say was like the best time to be spending R&D dollars in the blockchain Bitcoin space. But the firm had a remarkable ability to persevere and to stay the course. And really, it was the senior leadership that was driving all of that. And so I think it's paying dividends now. And the thesis around Bitcoin has really come around. And there's been these new platforms like Ethereum launched. And there's really a kind of a vibrant ecosystem here now that in retrospect looks obvious that as an asset manager, you should be deploying R&D dollars and trying to figure this out. But it wasn't always obvious. And so I see the same thing actually in other pockets of this industry where you have companies like PayPal and Square that are making very aggressive moves. And it's very much because the CEOs of those companies are believers and really putting the company on that course. Because if you have a leader that is not really fully bought into this, it's very easy to just listen to your chief risk officer or something and sit this one out for the next couple of years until more density is in the market in terms of market participants. But this is really where the big inflection points are and the big value creation drivers. So I think that's really been to the benefit of some of these leadership teams that have been willing to get out there on the risk curve.
That's a very insightful point. I'm glad you answered my question that way. Much more insightful. And so as you now go from Fidelity to Castle Island Ventures, how has that shift focus and what is that shift focus?
Yeah. So it's interesting. So Fidelity has the custodial infrastructure and the agency trading arm and is doing all sorts of things. Actually, the fund that we initially started under Fidelity's umbrella is now rebranded as Avon Ventures, and they're still very active. We've invested alongside them and think really highly of that group. So Fidelity has very much stayed the course. To answer your question, from our perspective, it's very much building your own business. We've been building the scaffolding and the infrastructure for an early stage venture fund. And that's really what we see ourselves doing for the next 20 years is focusing on these early stage opportunities, investing at the seed stage, and trying to find these companies that are really building this infrastructure and can build companies of consequence. The day-to-day is different every day. It's working with portfolio company CEOs. It's finding these companies. It's working with them through challenges. It's sitting on boards. It's been really exciting. So just from an entrepreneurial perspective, it's been a fun journey.
And so I'm sure along the way that you've been in touch and working with other venture firms, maybe not with the same focus as yours. And so I know you basically got cut from this space. So you don't have like years of experience in the prior venture work, but what do you see as some of the differences that you're dealing with that maybe some other early venture funds aren't?
Yeah, it's a good question, Eric. We very much see ourselves as a tailored early stage venture fund. So we don't see ourselves as crypto dedicated, crypto cowboy, investing in crypto tokens per se, but we really see this as the craft of early stage venture. Now, I think where that gets a little bit nuanced is you can think about just sector focuses for early stage funds. You'll have some funds that focus on biotech, some focus fintech, and there are funds that have these specializations. We do see our specialization as companies that are building infrastructure around public blockchain technology, and we really think that will be a paradigm shift. Now, where that sector focus probably comes into play the most is just understanding the roadmaps of some of these public blockchain protocols, because all these businesses are building on these kind of open source networks. And so understanding the glide path of those networks and what they're actually trying to be is very important. And to maybe give you a couple tangible examples there. So think about the early days of Bitcoin, 2013, 2014. One of the things that you saw a lot was companies, startups entering the space with the thesis that Bitcoin was going to disrupt the credit card companies. And these businesses were premised on the fact that they thought that the Bitcoin network itself at the base level was going to scale almost infinitely. There's this view that we could increase the block size and that the throughput on these networks were going to be able to withstand it. That turned out to actually be a pretty poor interpretation of what was going to happen at the base protocol layer. And so some of those businesses really struggled as that protocol did not evolve to meet the needs of their business. And so we think a really important thing within our sector is to really understand the projects, these open source communities, and what that governance looks like, what the technical roadmaps look like, so that you're not investing in a company that is premised on something that the protocol itself will not do. And so that's probably where the specialization pays the most dividends, is just hopefully avoiding some of these pitfalls and building on a foundation that actually isn't as sturdy as you perhaps thought it was.
So your most recent investment, Nova Bene, is really all about enabling digital asset firms to comply with the travel rule. But it is a more of an infrastructure play. It's not relying on a new coin or anything like that. It's basically building the infrastructure to draw from the chain the information necessary to share counterparty information across the various required parties and VASPs who are required to receive it under the travel rule.
And that's a big focus for us, is just core financial market infrastructure. We believe that these assets will be financialized, and you're already starting to see this. I think that there will be participation in this ecosystem with market participants that want to hold these assets as a savings technology, or want to hold these assets within the construct of how they hold other assets in their portfolio. So want to hold it with their brokerage firms, want to hold it with their custodians. We're investing heavily in it, and you're starting to see this initially with Bitcoin and stablecoins, is there's just a bunch of that plumbing that doesn't exist yet and is really preventing big institutions, big banks, and broker dealers from getting active in the space. And so for a number of years, that was custody. And in the early days of Fidelity, that was the number one thing that we realized, is that there were no institutional qualified custodians to hold these types of assets. And hey, maybe that's an opportunity to go out and build one. But it's across the landscape. And so if you could look at trading technology writ large, all of the connectivity that you would expect to see in traditional markets, you know, FX or fixed income markets, that doesn't really exist at scale yet in crypto assets. And the same thing for compliance, which we think is another big opportunity, maybe not the sexiest opportunity in the world. But if you think about these assets and you think about the rules that are in place, if you're moving other types of assets between financial firms. So let's say I'm moving my brokerage account over from Schwab into Fidelity. There's going to be identification on the other side of that transaction, even if it's just a wire transfer, actually. So you're moving several thousand dollars, you're going to have to pass information on from counterparty to counterparty around who that underlying owner of the asset is. And that's called the funds travel rule, more detailed than that, but that's basically what it is. And our view is that's something that these virtual asset service providers are going to need to comply with. It doesn't in any way, hopefully, impact the ability for users like you and I to hold self-sovereign our own keys. And we can participate in these networks however we want to participate. If you want to hold these assets on a ledger or Trezor and do peer-to-peer transactions like cash-style transactions, that's certainly something that people do. But if you want to hold your assets at Fidelity and move them to Coinbase, then you're probably going to fall under these compliance regimes. And we're investing in things like that, things that are enabling financial services firms and exchanges and brokerages to really start to offer these services. When you look at it, almost no banks or broker-dealers in the entire United States offer any of these services yet. You can't log on to your Chase account and buy Bitcoin yet, but I'm sure that will be coming. And as these custody and trade execution and compliance services get built, that really just unlocks the ability for these firms to actually participate in these markets in a safe way that doesn't get them in trouble with their regulators.
You were in Fidelity in a more of a traditional space and thinking about scenario planning and disruptors. Now that you're in a disruptive space, how do you approach scenario planning? What are the disruptors to your disruptive space?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the core tenet of scenario planning is to look at trends and uncertainties and to try to paint a picture of something that's quite disruptive. When I think about our industry, I think about potential disruptions just in the way that money works. Of course, a lot of these businesses that are in the Bitcoin space and the Ethereum space are going after this use case. But I think one potential transformative scenario would be almost a rethinking of the Bretton Woods system and the global dominance of the US dollar. And so if you look at the dollar just as a worldwide reserve asset right now, the US GDP is probably somewhere around 30% of total GDP in the world, but US dollar-based transactions are much higher, maybe closer to 60 to 70%. What would that look like if there was a threat or some sort of a change to the dollar's dominance? And what kind of the flow-through impact be to financial services in the United States and even to the United States itself and the ability to export dollars at scale? So that's probably, and I don't have an answer for that. I wish I did. But I think you can certainly start to see that there are trends and that are uncertainties that are pushing us in a direction where maybe there will be some alternatives. And the Chinese digital currency comes to mind as something that could potentially be competing for dominance. Mark Carney, on his way out at Jackson Hole a few years ago, was referencing some sort of a Bancor, other fiat currencies that could be treated as a basket. You're starting to see Libra. The original vision of Libra was essentially to create this kind of Bancor-based asset that could be used as an alternative. So I think you're starting to see enough signal out there that there's something happening here and that this is an eventuality that is maybe not properly accounted for in the market. And we don't really fully know what that transformative effect could be. So that's probably the one that I'm thinking about the most, just on a geopolitical landscape, is what would happen if the US dollar was just not as strong globally.
Where do you think the strengths would be in terms of companies responding to it and creating innovative technologies to help manage it?
So I think there's a couple different sides of that. One is there's a world where the US starts to embrace this technology in a much stronger way and enables things like US dollar stable coins and even potentially wholesale US dollar central bank digital currencies. We're starting to see that. There are companies that are operating in Latin America that are really allowing folks in other jurisdictions to have access to US dollars on their mobile phones in a seamless way. And most of these solutions are sitting on top of public blockchain infrastructure. And so Jeremy Allaire and the folks at Circle have been very publicly and prominently involved in some of these initiatives. If you think about that from the US's standpoint, from a geopolitical lens, it's really giving the US the ability to keep that advantage and to export dollars at massive scale, probably to the detriment of weaker fiat regimes. You could see a world where the US dollar just starts to eat alive these weaker fiat regimes, and people start to dollarize almost in a way that you've seen in Ecuador over the past 20, 30 years, where dollars start to become the dominant thing that's used. And maybe that starts to be on public blockchain infrastructure. So that's one vision of it. I think there's another vision where it's more disruptive and painful to the US, where China and other countries start to band around an alternative to the dollar and start to exit the SWIFT system and start to really retrench and denominate commodity transactions in other currencies, possibly a digital yuan. That starts to get quite disruptive if you think about the US's ability to levy sanctions and to really have visibility into the types of transactions that are happening. So I think it could go both ways, and it's just too early to tell at this point.
Interesting. Outside of regulatory clarity and security, what are some of the less obvious obstacles for the digital asset industry?
I think institutional politics is still a big one that people don't talk enough about. It's just very difficult to work on cutting edge projects within the context of big organizations. And you have these classic innovator dilemma issues where it's just really hard to introduce things to markets. That is something that I think we'll continue to see. And folks like Fidelity and MicroStrategy and Square and PayPal will be leading the charge there. But I think that's a big barrier. I think for big pockets of the cryptocurrency industry, the other potential barrier is just how these assets are classified. And so we've seen a wave of innovation around these token offerings. And yes, a lot of them were scams, but there are some enduring things that are being built. And whether or not these assets are securities is something that the industry is still wrestling with. And I think we haven't necessarily had a path forward there under the SEC where there can be some sort of a safe harbor or some sort of a way for assets that are issued by companies to eventually not be classified as securities. And so by and large, we've actually stayed away from a lot of these. We haven't been very active in companies that are issuing their own cryptocurrencies. But I think there's a lot of appetite there, and certainly a lot of investors have been active. But that is a big open question. And I think as the leadership at the SEC transitions over the next year, we're going to see what their posture is towards some of these tokens. I'm very eager to see where that lands. I think that's a big open question.
I was asking about governance tokens, because now you're seeing a lot of these projects roll out these governance tokens, being very careful to try to not classify themselves as a security. And I think as a technology sitting alone, right, not necessarily even selling it out to the public or doing airdrops or whatever, there are discrete industries and discrete use cases for governance tokens that I think obviously there's a lot of room for innovation and growth. So given that we're just talking about tokens and trying to make sure that they're not classified as securities, governance tokens might be a slightly safer topic. Do you have any investment thesis or long-term view on governance tokens?
Yeah, I think it's super interesting. I think that you're hitting on kind of the critical issue is just around how these things are classified in the eyes of a securities regulator. And that's what a lot of the entrepreneurs in that category are really wrestling with in trying to design these systems in a way that allows users to engage with these networks the way that they want them to engage with them, but also not be a security. And you can squint here and you can see that some of these things look like proxy voting or traditional services that we have in the financial services landscape around how you coordinate equity owners in a business, but they're not really that. They're equity owners in a distributed infrastructure around trading something or equity ownership eventually in something like a social network. To me, the key question is just how will the securities laws evolve or will they evolve in order to facilitate some of these things? But it's pretty clear that you can have this infrastructure that is not owned by one company. There's a use case there. I just think we're in the early days. We're certainly spending a lot of time evaluating it and we'll likely be making some investments in that category. But I think the big question is just around securities regulation.
Certainly a long-term question. Hopefully the new administration can appoint a chairman that maybe is a little more sympathetic. So where do you see the big opportunities that are potentially emerging in 2021?
We talk a lot about core financial market infrastructure, but one of the things that I'm most bullish on is just enterprise software businesses that start to realize that public blockchains make great public notary systems. And if you think about some of the surface area for design with just using a public blockchain to authenticate that something happened at a certain time and remove that need to trust a central third-party database operator to prove that and attest to that, I think the surface area is really wide. And so this is definitely not about just cutting out middlemen entirely from transactions, but I think it's about holding middlemen more accountable in building that trust. And so to give you a few examples, I know that you've had David Harris on the podcast before. I think data privacy is a really interesting use case. And if you can use a public blockchain to timestamp and provide audit logs for what big enterprises have done with specific customer data, that gives a level of trust and assurance in a transaction that can potentially just build. We could start to see market structures really evolve here with users having that trust in systems. Another use case that I'm really bullish on is around just proving the authenticity of photos or videos. Think about this as like solving the deepfake problem. So we have a company called Attestive that's working with insurance companies to prove whether or not a photo that's been submitted as part of an insurance claim is actually a real photo or has it been tampered with. And so they're just using a public blockchain to timestamp exactly when the photo or video was taken. And so to me, the surface area here is just huge. I think really any industry that has data that needs to be authenticated, attested to, anywhere where you need to trust someone like a notary or even just a database operator could be within that design purview. And so I think that we'll start to see more firms really glom onto that. I think that within the next 2 to 3 years, every photo that you take on a smartphone will probably have a blockchain fingerprint to it to prove whether or not it's real. So I'm really excited about some of these use cases.
Let's shift gears to DeFi a little bit. It's a little bit like drinking from a fire hose if you're trying to follow what's going on. What do you think has to happen for DeFi to grow up? And how does this sort of congeal in a way that sort of becomes a longer sustaining trend?
Yeah, it's hard to talk about DeFi without maybe, you know, I risk sounding like a Luddite to some degree, but I think the big question around DeFi, I do think that there are some enduring value that's being built here. These are truly novel systems, and this is the bleeding edge of what's being attempted in this industry. A lot of it is just attempts that are being tried in the wild for the first time and unclear regulatory environment, untested code, but it's really the bleeding edge. And if you think about this from the context of what this could be, this is really just building decentralized infrastructure for, around transactions. And it goes back to my original thing when we were looking at scenario planning at Fidelity, truly frictionless capital markets that occur peer-to-peer. That's a dream. And could you go out and get a loan from the internet? That's the vein of what's being attempted here. Now, I think the key question as an investor is regulatory clarity. And what we try to do is look at projects that we're appraising in the space through the lens of, is there a product market fit here if you had to add KYC, or if you had to add the ability to know the other side of a transaction? And by and large, there's probably not. I think there's a lot of regulatory arbitrage that's going on here. There's product market fit around things like gambling. And to a certain extent, these kind of look like toys. But I think you always have to remind yourself that all new disruptive things start looking like toys. Chris Dixon from Andreessen has this great quote around what the smartest people do on their nights and weekends is what most of us end up doing in 10 years during the week. And I think that kind of rings true when you look at DeFi, where the pace is just staggering. What's being attempted is really unprecedented. And something is going to come out of the other side of this. I think its timing is a big question, though.
Haseeb Qureshi of Dragonfly was talking about decentralization, and he made a compelling case for why decentralization wasn't as important as people in the DeFi industry would make you believe, that fundamentally you shouldn't be focusing on decentralization, but what is it that is actually garnering value?
I think that's something that you have to always go back to in this industry is, have you ever met a customer who, when you ask them what they want, say decentralization? So if you think about that in the context of Bitcoin, no one is saying I want decentralized money. They're saying I want the ability to hold value outside of the state, or I want to hold an asset that central banks cannot manipulate or the government cannot confiscate from me easily. And so the way to build that, it turns out, was to build a decentralized system. But if there's a way to do that in a centralized system faster, I'm sure it would have been built that way. Decentralization is just a means to an end. And in and of itself, I just don't think it's that attractive to the mainstream user base.
Right. And I often wonder whether a lot of the decentralized applications, they're effective because they're not necessarily depending on a centralized infrastructure, which can be expensive. It's almost like a test lab to try out different ideas. And if they work, I think you fast forward a few years, you'll see them centralized, and then you'll have a lot of purists crying, oh my God, they turned on their roots. But no, they actually found a more compelling value-generating use case for it by being adopted by a larger platform that could provide a lot of the things that centralization does provide.
I think that's well put. I think if you look at a lot of these projects right now that are gaining product market fit in DeFi, they definitely would not be possible in a centralized context in a way that regulators could get comfortable with. So think about betting markets and prediction markets. Companies like Intrade have done this in a centralized way and gotten shut down. And there's sort of this game of whack-a-mole that happens in that category. But if you're building that on decentralized architecture on Ethereum, it's going to be a lot harder to find those points of centralization and shut them down. And then if you bring that into the context of a business that's maybe not breaking laws, you could think about some of the platform lock-in that you have from centralized platforms. And so the classic kind of example that everyone in the crypto industry likes to use is around Facebook and what it was like as an app developer building games on top of Facebook if you're Zynga. And eventually you start to compete directly with the platform and they start to throttle your access and they start to restrict and compete with you. But if you're building on an open architecture like Ethereum, that just doesn't exist. So you're really free to do what you'd like on top of that platform. So there's nuances here, but I think there are certainly categories of businesses that are incredibly compelling in the context of being able to build on this open decentralized architecture.
Excellent. I'll ask you this open-ended question. What should I be asking you on this podcast that I'm not?
I think a big question in this industry that everyone's still wrestling with is just the US regulatory regime. And one thing that's top of mind for me right now is the ability to have self-custody of these assets. I think that's a really important thing. And it's important from a couple different perspectives. I think you can tackle that from a privacy and a First Amendment way, in that users should be able to hold their money in the same way they hold cash. People should have the ability to hold self-sovereign their own money. And so there are rumors that Coinbase CEO has been tweeting about looking at restricting some of that access. But I think the other end of that, other than just the First Amendment argument, is these systems, and specifically Ethereum, are really not built in that way. If you're exporting dollars off of Coinbase into an Ethereum smart contract, you actually don't even own that contract. No one owns that contract. So these things are just not architected in a way that is compatible with outlawing self-custody. It's something I think people in the crypto industry are really zoned in on right now. And given what's going on in Treasury with the turnover there, I think people are starting to pay a lot of attention to it.
Yeah, I think ultimately, if the SEC can draw a little clearer lines, provide more clarity on what constitutes a security, then you can say if it's security, maybe there's more of an emphasis on centralization and centralized custody. If it's not, then it has other use cases.
Yeah, you bring up a good point around securities. And that's another thing that I am really interested in, is just the definition of custody for a digital asset. it's going to have to change. If you think about holding one of these assets, the way that I would like to hold these assets would be, I would like to have a multi-signature arrangement, and I would like to have Fidelity have a key. I would love to have State Street have a key, and I would love to have a key or some sort of a scheme like that. I'd like to choose my own adventure on my key scheme. And so if that's the way that we're doing it, who's the ultimate custodian? And what is that definition of a good control location in the eyes of the regulator? If truly Fidelity cannot move my asset, State Street cannot move my asset, and I cannot move it unilaterally. So I think we'll be forced to reevaluate that definition of custody as the market evolves. Right now, the first step is just that Fidelity will hold all of the keys. And that's fine. I trust Fidelity, knock on wood. But I think the safest way to do this would be to have some sort of a key segregation scheme.
I know that one of your portfolio companies, and I wasn't prompted to ask this, Casa, actually holds a key as part of their services to provide that additional layer of security. Maybe you want to talk a little bit about what they do in the context of this.
Yeah, and I think this is a super attractive offering. So Casa has multiple key schemes that you can choose from. 3 of 5 is one of them. 2 of 3 is another, where Casa will hold one of the keys for you. You can hold one. You could give one to your lawyer, your accountant, your spouse, and really just use their software to figure out how to aggregate those keys. And that's really popular right now in the context of people that hold Bitcoin and want to hold that outside of a custodian and want to hold that in a way that reduces single points of failure. You don't want to hold just one hardware wallet and carry it in your briefcase. Obviously, that's not a very secure thing to do. But if you were to split these up and use something like Casa, that brings that level of security. I would be shocked if that doesn't evolve to an institutional offering, whether it's Casa or someone else doing it at some point. The benefits of having that decentralized key approach and that key management scheme are just incredibly powerful. You see the traditional custodians do this already anyways, behind the scenes, they're splitting up keys between data centers in different jurisdictions, different states, different countries. But having that outside of just one siloed institution, that's where we're going. Whether the industry knows it or not, like, we're going to have to go there. That's the most secure way to hold these things. You don't want to live in a world where Coinbase and Fidelity have 50% of the world's Bitcoins under their custody. It's just not a very safe world to live in.
Right. And Casa, is it primarily retail focused or institutional focused?
It's retail focused. I just don't think that we have the institutional clarity on the definition of custody to be able to have something like that in the wild for a sovereign wealth fund yet. And I think that's not something they want. They want to just trust Fidelity and go from there. But it'll evolve in the same way that market structure evolved in traditional equity securities, and we invented the DTCC and we invented clearing firms and all of these things. It will evolve in the crypto asset space such that custody just gets a lot safer, hopefully sooner rather than later.
I'm going to drop a pitch for my podcast with Joel Revel, which actually you also had a podcast with Joel Revel. So Joel Revel with Two Ocean Trust, they got a no action letter from the Wyoming Division of Banking that they were a qualified custodian for the purposes of the Investment Advisors Act, and specifically with regards to digital assets. So they published this. And then 1 week later, the SEC makes a public statement calling for basically people to start to respond. Should we redefine what a qualified custodian is? Or should we set different standards, et cetera? What was interesting about that was, you know, first of all, the Division of Banking did notify the SEC prior to publishing their no action letters. And so they did the responsible thing. But what was interesting about that was they've called for comments. So I read that as a very positive signal that they were taking it on in a more measured approach. My only concern is that I hope that those that are most threatened by it don't dominate that discussion.
Yeah, there's a lot of things to react to in what you just said. I agree with it. I think it's a hugely positive news. I think it's very clear at this point that there are people within the SEC that are very knowledgeable about this and moving quickly. And in reaching out to entrepreneurs and trying to understand what they're building and trying to be forthcoming. It's certainly not everyone at the SEC, but I think there are people within the SEC that are very aware that this could be a great boom for just the US economy. And if you think about the SEC's, one of their mandates is to really promote capital formation. And this is a big time growth industry. So I think it's great to see them acting so quickly. And I think we'll get that clarity. I think that when we get it, we'll see, but I think it's pretty clear that we're going down that path. And there are a tremendous amount of broker dealers that are pushing for that clarity behind the scenes, is my perception, at least, where you've had certain firms that are wanting to do things around tokenizing real world securities, certain firms that are wanting clarity on holding Bitcoin on their balance sheet. These firms have been waiting in line for a long time with SEC and FINRA. And I think hopefully we'll start to get that clarity. But I agree with you. I think that we'll see what comes out of that. I imagine we'll get some pretty interesting comments. I'm interested to see what gets posted on their request for comments.
And maybe if they figure out the custody side of things, as well as the securities, they can start approving more of these BD and ATS applications, which would also be a real accelerant for digital asset trading industry, at least.
That's a big thing holding back all of these tokenized security offerings right now, is that you don't have a density of ATS venues to provide the secondary market liquidity on it. It's a market structure problem. And then as a result, maybe you don't see the top flight issuances happening on these type of platforms, because it's just easier to go somewhere else. And that will change over time. And I think having the custody and having ATS venues that are more active and prevalent in the market, and just more clarity around that, I think that's what we need. And then at some point, we'll see these tokenized securities actually start to work and connect to legacy systems.
Matt, thank you so much for being on the show. This was really great. I appreciate it. Where can people go to learn more about you and to learn about your podcast as well?
Yeah, no, thanks, Eric, for having me. Best place to learn about us is our website. It's castleisland.vc, as in dot venture capital. And you can follow us on Twitter and check out our website, which is On the Brink.
Excellent. Once again, Matt, thanks so much. It was great having you on the show.
Great. Thanks, Eric.